Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 29 of Nerd Pride Radio. 29, the number of newts in one sickle in the wizarding currency of Harry Potter's world. Even cooler than that, though, the year 2029, that's the year an asteroid named Apophis will make a close pass of Earth. And the results of that pass will determine whether or not Apophis is going to destroy us in 2036. So, on that positive note, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus there's probably seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff I just can't fit in my head anymore. And as long as we're here, I'd like to welcome a new staff member to the Nerd Pride crew this week. Yancey has signed on with us. Welcome, Yancey. He is officially our new fanfic proofreader. Yay! Good for you, man. All right. First off, updates! Okay, I finally got to the end of Power Man. Remember, Joel loaned me his Power Man compilation, first 27 issues of Hero for Hire Power Man. And so I get all the way through 27 issues. And before I raved about how retro, campy, kind of cool it was, and then I got bogged down. I read the first, like, dozen or so episodes, issues, pretty quickly. And then I got bogged down bad because they switched writers. And I realized, oh, yeah, these are the things I hated about comics when I was younger. That especially, you know, Power Man, but all comics at this time, but Power Man especially, they were looking to attract new readers. They were looking for, their big money wasn't coming from regular subscribers. It was coming from the people who were picking them up off the newsstands. And so therefore, they wanted every issue, you had to be able to come in fresh and new on a new issue and be able to follow the storyline. And so here, pretty much every event, every storyline, every everything is covered in basically one issue, which there's no real ongoing. I mean, there was some ongoing story, but not much. Or if it went on for two issues, if you had a big explosive, you know, continued next month, then they had to spend the first four pages of part two just explaining what happened in part one, because God forbid that anyone should be lost or have to go find that issue or whatever. And it just bogged down. It was terrible. I would guess there were three or four of those final ones I got to that it was just so much exposition. Half the book was exposition. He wound up, Power Man ran into the Circus of Crime, the cleverly named Circus of Crime. Convenient, because then you know you're allowed to kick their asses because they have crime right in their name, right? See? Easy to know who's evil when they name themselves evil. And the Circus of Crime was like six minor league bad guys, and every single one of them had to spend like two or three panels explaining who they were and why they were here and how they came to be part of this outfit and where their powers came from and what it is they can exactly do. And they're honestly explaining all of the, you know, Power Man at this point is hypnotized and pretty much comatose. And so they are explaining all of this, like three pages worth of exposition. And they're explaining all of it to a captive girl who is really, you know what, if they just hypnotized her, she wouldn't have broken out in the first place, and the whole thing would have been over in two panels. Bad guys win. But no. They have to hold her captive, and as if she is James Bond, they have to then spend three pages explaining everything just for the benefit of the poor reader. Oh, it was sad. So sad. But redeeming quality, redeeming point, issue 27, and I see why they ended on issue 27. They got yet another new writer, and issue 27 was actually really, really good. It was nonsensical in a lot of ways. The whole thing, the whole event happens because of sheer coincidence, really, and unbelievably far-fetched hand of fate intervening sort of coincidence that would never, ever, ever happen in a reasonable story, but it did. And it turns out that Power Man gets a lot of time for introspection and looking off plaintively into the distance. And it turns out he's kind of a dick. And it was really kind of cool because really, by the end of the story, there's a man dead because Power Man was just kind of a douche, which made for a really interesting story. So Power Man, the original 27-issue run, all compiled in Marvel Essentials, best of, whatever it's called. I think it's Marvel Essentials. Can't really recommend it, but, you know, read the first half, and exciting. And then the final issue, read issue 27. And then that's pretty much it. You've really got the gist of it. I mean, Joel says he has more for me. I think it's going to be Avengers next time. We'll see. I don't even know which run of Avengers he's given me. I know he's told me, but I don't remember. So I think that's next, but we'll see how it goes. I'll keep you posted. And then after I make a lame segue, it's time for the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week or two. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and then the best stuff off that list gets spewed out onto you every week when I record. You lucky dogs. And the first thing on my master list is, well, it's my gaming table.
You can't really call it a game. It was an obscenity.
I'm weaning.
So here's the deal. Rave Master, hi Rave, posted up on the boards that he and a friend or two wanted to start playing Dungeons & Dragons, that they had the books or had a book or whatever, and they were going to start playing, and nobody involved has gamed before, therefore, what do we recommend? All right, and similarly, friends of my brother, people who have, I don't know if they still do, but people who have been to the website have followed the podcast in the past, and apparently, they are inspired by the raucous tales of Dungeons and Dragoning that my son and his friends and I do. And so these guys, not able to get into our group because we're already full up, have decided that they're going to start their own. And they're going to try playing some Dungeons and Dragons. They have the books. They have the books for, I assume, D&D 4. I don't even know what version they've got. But they're trying to put together a game. And again, none of them have played before. But they're inspired, and they're dedicated, and they're going to give it a shot. And so when Rave first asked, so what do you guys recommend? How do we get started? My mind first went out to, and I posted up a bunch of stuff about this, that, you know, well, maybe Dungeons & Dragons is a little complicated. You know, Dungeons & Dragons, D&D, is just a big thing, no matter how you approach it. Even if you start with, you know, Pathfinder, the Pathfinder box set, the D&D 4 box set, even if you start with any of this stuff, D&D, Pathfinder, whatever you play, is still a huge, complicated game, and it is tough. And so you think to yourself, well, there's some simpler games out there, some simpler games that, you know, give you the basic structure of the rules, give you some high adventure, but you don't have to learn quite so much. That learning curve is not quite so steep to get yourself involved in the hobby. And so maybe it would be worth their time to pick up something like that and get themselves started. And there were lots of recommendations out there. But then I think it was Paul. I think it was Serious Paul. But somebody posted up and said, you know what? If you want to play, just play. Grab the game, muscle your way through it, and play. That's all you do. And I realized that, you know what? He's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Forget all of my previous advice. Rave, I hope you've already started playing. I hope you and your friends have given it a shot. Because even crappy D&D, when you first start out, even crappy D&D is awesome. It is so much fun. And so now, seeing as how's that, that's the sum total of the advice, I'm going to back up a little bit and give you my first experience just because, all right, look, my first experience was my brother and I were being babysat by some family friend, and he wanted to play D&D. He obviously was a D&D player. He broke out some books. He was, you know, 2-3 years older than we were, and he broke out some books, and we gamed. And my brother and I had no clue what we were doing. We had no idea how any of this stuff worked, and yet we were fascinated by the whole idea. By the end of it, I realized it's some sort of choose-your-own-adventure, but the Dungeon Master has the book, and so I assumed when I bought the stuff, I assumed that that big Dungeon Master's guide would have all of the choose-your-own-adventures options on it and tell me what page to turn to when the players did X. And it turns out it wasn't like that at all. And so there it was, me at 11 years old. I bought it before that, but never had a chance to play. I read it and read it and read it, never made any sense of this thing. And so here I am, 11 years old, sixth grade, and I've got the Dungeons & Dragons basic set, the boxed set in the red box. That's what I own, all right? I met some guys at school, and Steve happened to own the Dungeons & Dragons expert set, the blue box. And we're like, okay, I've got levels 1 through 3, you've got levels 4 through 6. If we combine this, maybe we can make heads or tails of this thing and get a real game going. And I remember we sat there for a session or two sessions, and we tried to make characters because, okay, character creation rules make sense. But how we actually play, and I remember us looking at those charts, and finally the light went on for one of us. And we're like, oh, wait. Someone had an armor class on their sheet. This table tells us, oh, if you can roll that number, I get it. And something snapped. But it took us forever. I mean, I owned that book for like 6 months, flipping through it, reading it, thinking I knew what was going on, but I didn't. And then we got together for a couple of sessions. I mean, this is hours of us puzzling it out together. And finally something clicked. And then we met John. And John, through his brother, had access to all of the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons books, all the hardcovers. So we had this big stack of hardcover books now. And somewhere in that, we puzzled it all out. And now this sounds like a long, arduous process. It really does. But every step of it was fun, and we had a great time. And there were some frustrating things. But also, Rave, you and my son's friends, for that matter, you guys were all older. I mean, you're teenagers. This was a bunch of 11-year-olds. We were little kids trying to figure this out. You guys have a little more life experience. You guys have resources, the internet, us, to answer your questions and give you some advice. And when something doesn't make sense, we can at least tell you why it works the way it does, even if it still doesn't make any sense after that. And I think you guys can puzzle through it way faster than a bunch of 11-year-olds. We played. I can't even imagine playing that sort of game now. When I go retro and I want to play some kind of old school dungeon crawl sort of thing, I can't go back to what we ever did at 11, 12 years old. I can't even fathom doing that because it was, literally you walk into a room, you hack and slash whatever is in there to death. You gather all of its treasure, calculate your experience points. If you level up, let's do it. All right, now move on to the next room. Do it all over again. And we did this over and over and over for years. And part of it was, we spent a good 6 months playing where, as a dungeon master, I obviously didn't realize the idea of giving appropriate challenges. And fortunately, Dungeons & Dragons 4 is all about appropriate challenge levels, as is D&D 3 to a lesser extent. But, they give monsters challenge ratings, and they explain in great detail in the books what kind of opposition to throw at your players to make sure that everything's about even, that they're going to have a challenge, but they're probably not going to die if they play it smart, that sort of thing. Whereas, the sky was the limit when we played. The ultimate end of that short-lived Monty Hall campaign at the beginning, it was they walked in, they hacked and slashed, they were never in any real danger, and they carted away warehouses full of treasure in bags of holding on their backs. In fact, I don't even think we had bags of holding back then. We just assumed that you could carry 50,000 pounds of gold with you. And because encumbrance is really not important at all. And they wound up, as a group, slaying the Platinum Dragon because they wanted his brain to make a potion of immortality. And that's really where the thing finally came to an end. We played through all these grand things, and they killed larger and larger creatures until finally it got to killing the Tiamat, killing Bahamut, killing these gods of dragons in these ludicrous battles where I did not, I had no concept of playing a villain to its fullest extent, no concept of how to play those. But ultimately, they did slay these gods of dragons, and they made their potion of immortality, and we pretty much, we had every intent to keep on playing. This was obviously just the beginning. But at that point, we just kind of trailed off. We cut out a bunch of players who weren't really very serious about the game anyway. We tightened up and reformed. We started over at low level. One can just assume that those old characters were left behind as immortal gods, because that's what they had become. And we moved on, and we learned a different style of play. And it was still, you know, room-to-room, dungeon-crawling, hack-and-slash. But at least this time, you know, there were some appropriate challenges, and there were some puzzles, and there was some more creative stuff in it, and it built from there. And that's a kind of retro gaming that I think I could do for a while. You know, I could make a whole campaign out of that. But the idea of grabbing my random group of players and then just dropping them in a dungeon where, for no reason, they now have to find their way out. And they have to slog from room to room, you know, sleeping in the dungeon, finding food in the dungeon, learning, you know, healing themselves, making their way through. I could have a lot of fun with that, I think. Although, again, players are more sophisticated nowadays. I mean, I've had a few things where, when it turns out it was just a random encounter, or what seemed like to the players a random encounter, they come away going, so that was it? There was no reason for that? I mean, honestly, we took all this damage and it didn't mean anything? And so I take that kind of to heart. And so now, you know what? I've gone far afield. Honestly, here's the deal. If you're new to the game, Rave, all right, Ginger, the rest of you, if you're new to the game, just go play, all right? If you've got questions, ask them, but otherwise, get the game, put it together as best you can. If Dungeons & Dragons is what interests you, I would still recommend Pathfinder, but hey, if Dungeons & Dragons interests you, then just play it. Just figure it out and play it, and don't worry that it's too complicated. Don't worry that there might be some simpler game out there or some other way to do this. Whatever. Just play the darn thing, and you'll be better for it. Honestly, you will have a great time. No question. But I've grown so tired of segues, so let's just go straight to the science corner.
She blinded me with science!
And that means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. I've been reading a lot about dark energy and dark matter lately, specifically dark energy. And the best part about reading about dark energy on the internet is getting to read the comments afterwards. And I say best thing because I'm being sarcastic, and it's not really good at all, because it's so terribly frustrating to watch people argue about science they don't understand on the internet. It's great. And so, here's the thing. Dark energy, for those of you who aren't aware of it, the universe, popular theory states, started in a big bang, and everything was expanding outward, and by some models, you know, eventually there should be enough matter to contract back and slam everything together, and we'll end in a big crunch. Well, clearly, we're not doing that. We're continuing to expand, and the experiments that have been conducted, the observations that have been made, show us that it looks like the universe is going to keep on expanding forever. And as we make measurements of the universe, it turns out that there is a crap ton of matter out there, gravitationally active matter that is affecting the movements of galaxies and galaxy clusters and everything else. And this huge amount of matter, more matter than what we can see, is out there somewhere, and we can't see any of it. We don't know what it is, and thus it has been dubbed dark matter because, well, we know it's out there. We know something is out there because it's got a gravitational effect. We can see it all happening. We can't see the matter itself, so we've dubbed it dark matter. All right. But more than that, there's also some massive amount of energy out there that is working in opposition to gravity. And if I'm wrong about any of this, somebody please correct me. I read a lot, and I love science and physics, and I love astronomy. I love all of this stuff. But my grasp of the facts can sometimes be a little tenuous because I do my best, but these are advanced concepts. So if someone's got a better way of explaining it or corrections to make on what I'm saying, let me know. But something out there, some force is acting in opposition to gravity, thus increasing the expansion of the universe and not allowing it to collapse in on itself, basically. And by the measurements they're taking, if I remember correctly, this energy, this unseen energy, dark energy, again, we can't see it, we just can see what it does. We can see its effects. And this dark energy makes up something like 70% of the mass energy of the entire universe. 70% of the universe, causing this huge effect that that has huge ramifications for the ultimate fate of the universe and the formation of the universe, and yet we can't see it. We have no idea what it is. Well, not no idea. There are some good candidates. There are people who are working out great theories about what might cause something like this. But we don't know what it is, and so we call it dark energy because we can see its effects. We just don't have any idea what it is yet. Okay, this is great. And again, I read everything I can find on this stuff. I am fascinated even when it's over my head. I consume it like crazy, hoping to pick up tidbits from what's there in the article. And then, after I get done reading the article, I go down to the comments section, and invariably, there is someone out there who is going to comment that they don't believe in dark energy. They don't believe in dark energy. It's all some fabrication. It's all a trick of mathematics because, well, we need to invent dark energy in order for our math to work. And you can explain to them as often as you like. Not that I've tried, but I've seen others try. You can explain to them as often as you like that it's not about believing in it or not believing in it. The effects of it are there. Something is causing this, and we don't know what it is, so we dub it dark energy. So you can believe in dark energy or not. It doesn't make any difference. The effects of it are still there. Something is happening. We just have to figure out what. But they're acting like the whole thing is just this huge myth. And to follow up with that, you get the, okay, I don't believe in dark energy. And then similarly, you get people who will then compare dark energy to ether or dark energy to bodily humors or compare dark energy to, you know, the four-element theory of the universe or whatever, implying that, oh, this is just some outdated superstition, and eventually, you know, we'll learn better and we'll get over it. And I think they all missed the point. Somewhere in the midst of one of these arguments a month or so ago, someone pointed towards an article by Isaac Asimov called The Relativity of Wrongness. And this is an article that Asimov wrote, I don't know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago? I can't even remember. But look for The Relativity of Wrongness. You can find it online, and it's a brilliant piece. And the essential point, and in fact, it was a letter, an answer to someone who was saying exactly these sorts of things about how, you know, science, and you put that in quotes, science has always had these incorrect theories, and every, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, there's some great paradigm shift, and we learn that everything we used to know was wrong, and now we understand better, okay? But Asimov's point is, we've always been wrong. We're probably still wrong, but you know what? Today, we're less wrong than we were 10 years ago. All right, 10 years ago, they were less wrong, certainly, than they were a century before that. Yes, Isaac Newton came up with his theory of gravitation, laws of motion, and came up with a pretty good explanation for how things worked. Now, later, relativity supersedes that. Einstein's theory of relativity supersedes Newton, but even though Newton was technically wrong, his ideas are still a good model for how things work. And his theories, his calculations, his everything is still used by people today for a lot of stuff. It doesn't mean, it's still technically wrong, but it's less wrong than Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle, you know, brilliant in his day, the foremost thinker of his day, and yet we can pretty much discount most of what he said about physics at that point. So Newton, yes, wrong, but less wrong than before, all right? And so basically Asimov is saying that all we're doing is fine-tuning it. Yeah, we've still not got it exactly right. We still aren't sure about a lot of things, but each day, each year, as science progresses, we are less wrong than we were last time, all right? Everything gets us closer and closer to, hopefully, some ultimate truth. And even if we never get there, we'll have a pretty good idea by the time we get to the end of this. You know what I mean? And I found that absolutely brilliant. I can't believe I've never seen this article before. Again, Isaac Asimov, The Relativity of Wrongness. Go out and find it and read it. It won't even take you but 5 minutes, and it'll be worth your time. Good article. Which brings me to my science fiction double feature. Science fiction double feature. That's right. Here at Nerd Pride Radio, you get not one, but two movie reviews for the same low, low price. All right. The movies I'm going to review this week are not Roadhouse, and Red Dawn. That's what I wanted to do, all right? I wanted to do a Patrick Swayze back-to-back combo because I've just seen both of them recently. But as it turns out, I already mentioned Red Dawn on the podcast and talked about it at great length in episode 24. So if you would like to hear the Roadhouse, Red Dawn, Patrick Swayze combo review, then listen to the first half here and then go back to episode 24 and listen to that segment and pretend that I said it all at once. Here's the thing. I got Roadhouse from Netflix, and I have never seen Roadhouse. All right, I mean, I've never seen it. I've never seen any part of it, ever, ever. I mean, people are telling me, oh, God, but it's on TNT all the time, or TBS, or whatever station it is. They play this thing all the time on cable. How can you not have seen it? I've never even seen a little bit of it, all right? All I know about Roadhouse is that Patrick Swayze is a bouncer at a CD club, and he beats the hell out of people throughout this movie. That's the entire extent of it, okay? And I know my brother and my cousin and my dad and everybody I knew saw it back in, '90 or whenever this thing came out, and they loved it, all right? Everybody loved this movie. And they kept telling me I had to see it, kept telling me I had to see it, were shocked that I hadn't, and I still, now, haven't seen it. So now I finally have. I'm caught up. Oh, wait, there it is in my notes, 1989. Okay, here's what I didn't know about this movie. I did not realize what an 80s movie this was. Holy crap, like a punch in the gut. I mean, and it's not just the mullet on Patrick Swayze, although it was a gorgeous mullet. It's not the mullets on everybody, although there were a lot of them. It was the pleated pants. All right. It was the pastel colored shirts on everybody. It was the hair, the girl's hair. It was when they remade the bar, because I didn't realize they did that. They start with the CD dive and they remake it, and it turns into this such an 80s cliche dance jazz club looking thing. It was ridiculously 80s. The entire thing beginning to end, it screamed 1980s. And just overwhelmingly so. Did that make it a bad movie? Well, no, because here's the deal. You know what wasn't 80s in this movie? Sam Elliott, all right? Sam Elliott without the beard and mustache, although he was pretty grizzled through this whole thing, but Sam Elliott as the greatest bouncer of all time, and he kicked ass. Sam Elliott was my hero. Oh, my God, I want to be Sam Elliott from Roadhouse. This thing was so good. The fight scenes are, they're Roadhouse fight scenes. There's lots of violence, some of it for no good reason. Patrick Swayze opens up the movie with his Zen Buddhist philosophy of peace, and be nice. And once the fighting starts, man, that just goes right out the window, and they just kick ass all over everything. All right, and if you've seen this movie, if you haven't seen this movie, I don't care about spoilers. I'm just talking about it. God, if you haven't seen Roadhouse, go watch it. Go watch it. It is silly. It is ridiculous. But it's fun. It's a lot of fun. And like I say, stuff happens for no reason. There's the motivation is so paper thin, so contrived. They come up with, this monster businessman is terrorizing this poor little town, and nobody can stand up to him because he owns the cops and he runs everything. And you know what? There were so many. The guy confesses to being evil in this movie so many times. All it would take is one recording and a trip down to the FBI, and you'd have this guy on extortion, murder, arson, assault. There's so much in there. But no, we can't do that. We have to handle this ourselves. We'll find a way. All right. And then at the very end of the movie, all right, dude is laying dead with 5 shotgun holes in him, blood everywhere, house torn to pieces. His personal bodyguard, like 5 or 6 guys, dead everywhere. One of them is in the lake with his throat torn out, okay? Huge, violent, awful, bloody. I mean, Patrick Swayze is beat up. He's got blood all over him. But quick, before the cops show up, the cops who are in the dead dude's pocket, quick before the cops show up, everybody hide all the guns. And then when the cops come and, hey, what happened? Well, I didn't see nothing. How about you? Nope, I didn't see nothing either. And that's it. They all have a chuckle about it, and then we go to our happy ending where they swim naked in the river. All right? That's it? Even the stupidest movie I've ever seen didn't have the balls to end it on that note. All right? I mean, we are talking, you've just walked into a scene of a slaughter. All right? Cops burst in, dead guys and blood everywhere. And all the guys standing around beat up with blood on them just hid the guns. All of them are standing there going, nope, I didn't see nothing. And so we let them go. Well, that's it. 80s happy ending. We're happy. Let's go. I had so much fun watching this. And again, you got to know going into it, it's stupid. It's Australian. It is as bad as it's going to get. All right. You know that walking into it. But with that in mind, you can really enjoy this. Fight scenes are great. Sam Elliott is a god. Absolutely worth watching. So there you go. That's number one. Number two on my science fiction double feature, because at heart, I am a teenage girl, Hunger Games. I've seen Hunger Games twice now. All right. I raved about the books a few episodes ago, and now I've seen the movie twice, and I got to tell you, it's a good movie. That's it. It's a good movie. If you've read the books, then the movie is not quite as much as the books. I mean, the movie was, the first time I went with my wife for my birthday, and I enjoyed it a lot. And I was really, really moved by a lot of pieces. I mean, there's parts that make you want to cry. There's parts that make you want to jump for joy. But I kept comparing throughout the entire movie. All I could do is compare it to, okay, well, that's different from the books. Oh, I like this better than the books. But, oh, I can't believe they left that part out. It misses so much meaning. And so there were lots of things where it was really touching, really powerful and moving. But I kept wondering to myself, yeah, but am I really just liking it just because I know what that means? Because the movie didn't explain some of that, and yet I get it because I've read the books. So am I some, you know, Twilight fangirl here who can love these crappy movies just because I know what the books are and I'm just overlaying my own personal vision onto this movie I'm seeing? Because that's really possible. And even if that's the truth, then hey, I got a great experience out of it. But I had that little bit of distraction. And also, during stressful scenes of really heavy action. Oh, they went with the handheld cam. I hate the handheld cam. I just can't even tell you how much I hate the handheld cam. I'm sorry. Hold that thing steady. Let me see what's going on, for God's sake. But at least they use it mostly sparingly. The second time I watched the movie, didn't even notice the cam after the first 5 minutes of the movie. Didn't even remember that it was a handheld cam half the time. But if you haven't seen the movie yet, let me tell you what's different. The books are entirely in Katniss's head, okay? Pretty much everything you see in the books comes from her point of view, and you get a lot of time in her head with her thoughts and her worries and doubts and everything. And it's a very personal sort of story that way. Whereas, obviously, in the movie, we can't be inside her head, you know, right? So when a gift comes down, and in the book, you get her entire thought process to have her working out what this thing means, what she did, how this is a consequence of it, what this means for her future actions, how it's going to look to everybody. So you get all that in her head and you get to see it. Well, this time they can't do that. So, you know, the gift has to come with an accompanying note that lets us, the audience, know that that's what they were thinking. And that's just one small example. So the movie doesn't get that inside view. I mean, like I say, the books, a lot of the books are internal. Just so much of it. And so it is very different to shift to a movie where it's not. But the other thing that the movie did to compensate for that, they gave us a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, a lot of the stuff that Katniss wouldn't see. I mean, the whole thing is this huge televised production. And so we get to see the production crew in studio making everything happen. All right. Rather than having her, you know, surmise what must have happened in her head and go, oh, well, they must be trying to do this. That's why. No, we get to see the TV production crew actually making that decision and say, and it was really cool. That was a great choice. I loved seeing that because it gave the whole, I don't think I'm giving anything away. I mean, either you've read Hunger Games, you've seen the movie, you want to see the movie, or you haven't. Either way, I'm not going to give away much. But you get this juxtaposition in the books of the poor versus the rich. All right, the outlying districts and the oppression that they suffer and the meager lives that they lead compared to the exorbitant, extravagant excesses of the capital and its citizens, their clownish clothing and makeup, their decadent excess in their foods and their entertainments and everything else. And the movie, I thought, did a spectacular job of highlighting that, because you got to see them in the games, the struggles that they're going through, and then you cut back to the TV production crew, the audience, the reactions of the sponsors and the other stuff, and you get to see the very keen juxtaposition of these two worlds throughout the film. I really like that. So, tell you what, second time I watched the film, again, first time I went with my wife, the second time I promised my son he could go, and then it didn't work out to take him on my birthday, so, well, it was actually the day after my birthday. But then I took him a couple weeks later, and we had a great time. He loved it. I loved it. And this time, I'd already seen it once. I could stop worrying and thinking about it. I'd already done all the analysis in my head. I could just kick back and just enjoy the film. And I really did. I had a great time watching it. So those are my two reviews. I've got Roadhouse and I've got Hunger Games. And I recommend both of them, but, you know, with a few reservations. But highly recommend. There you go. Although, before I wrap up my review, I guess my other criticism is I wish the movie could have been longer. I mean, it's 2 hours and 22 minutes. That's a fairly long movie, okay? But there's a lot that was in the books that could have been in the movie. There was a lot of, you know, her and Rue had long conversations in the book that gave a lot of insight into the people in the districts and this kind of stuff. And those conversations were just completely left out. And I understand their time constraint. Look, this was the first Hunger Games movie. This is the first in what they were hoping was a blockbuster franchise. But you don't want to intimidate people. You don't want to take too many huge risks by going for, you know, a 3.5-hour film, first one out of the gate. So I understand why they didn't expand it. But I fully expect that the second movie will be much longer. And then I fully expect that, just like Harry Potter, just like the Twilight Breaking Dawn, I fully expect that the third and final movie will actually be broken into two parts because they need to get it all in there. And you know, and it's the right choice to make. I wish there had been more of it. I wish there had been a lot of those things that I was missing. But, oh well, what are you going to do? Whew, all right, so what do we do next? That's right, it's time for the Badass Movie Quote of the Week. This one is Robert De Niro as Neil McCauley in the movie Heat. Quote, "There's a flip side to that coin. Well, if you do got me boxed in, then I gotta put you down. Because no matter what, you will not get in my way. We've been face to face, yeah, but I will not hesitate. Not for a second." End quote. That's it. I just think that's badass. Robert De Niro is a god among movie actors for a reason. The man is just a good actor, and he is scary and intimidating even when he's not trying to be. I mean, the man's presence fills the screen. And if Robert De Niro tells me he's going to put me down, he won't blink an eye. He won't hesitate for a moment. He'll put me down. I believe him. I'm not even in that film, and I know he'll do it. So there you go, Robert De Niro. Badass movie quote of the week. Which means all that's left really is the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Well, you send your question or your topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums, and I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. Hey, you know what I haven't done in a long time? I haven't explained the fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. Okay, my kids owned a Star Wars version of the game Trouble, and this Trouble game came with the pop-o-matic bubble in the middle, just like every Trouble game. But inside it, since the Star Wars version, there's R2-D2. All right, and so when you pop the thing, R2-D2 flips around inside, the dice roll, and then you wind up getting the R2-D2 noise. I have taken the R2-D2 bubble, I cracked it open, and replaced the six-sided die that was inside with a couple of tens. Actually, it's a set of percentile dice, so one of them rolls 10 to 100, the other one rolls, or 0 to 90, the other one rolls 0 to 9. Anyway, every time I pop this bubble, R2 gives me a roll from 1 to 100, and I go and I look, I shuffle up my pod-o-matic list every week, so the first 100 items change every week, but we're always just looking at the first 100 items for each week. And then he rolls up numbers, and whatever's on there, that's what I talk about. And this time, oh crap, this second roll, I don't even remember what the first one was, the second roll that I just introduced, R2 gives us a 99. 99 is from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul says, why do you think Eddie Murphy stopped for that cross-dressing hooker? Okay. If I had to make a guess, I would say Eddie Murphy was planning on giving that cross-dressing hooker money in exchange for sexual favors. But that's just off the top of my head. I don't know Eddie Murphy. I don't know for sure. Number 10. Ooh, this one's from Daz. Daz says, F, Mary, Kill, which in this case we've now amended to Kiss, Mary, Kill. He's going to give me three options to choose from. Now, of those three, I'm going to have one that I choose for a wild night of kissing. The second one that I will have to marry and remain with for the rest of my natural life. And then the third one that I'm going to kill. All right. And the choices offered to me are Angel, Buffy, and Arthur, the Tick's sidekick. Oh, that is such a tough choice. Wow, that is really, really tough. You know what? Oh man, I don't know where to go with this one. I really don't. I'm gonna have to kill Arthur. I'm sorry, Arthur. I love you. I do. But I'm gonna have to put you down. Because Arthur, while you seem to be a great guy, one, I don't want to kiss you. And two, I think you would annoy me if I was married to you for the rest of my life. So I'm going to take my wild night of passionate snogging with Angel, and I assume we mean Angel the vampire from the Buffy Angel series from Joss Whedon. I assume so. That's what I'm going with. And then I'm going to marry Buffy. And this was the toss-up for me. I didn't know which way I wanted to go because really, if I had to choose one for a wild night of passion, obviously, I want Buffy over Angel. I really, really do. But then I realize, do I want to be married to a slayer for the rest of my life or a dirty vampire? And obviously, I can't live with a vampire for the rest of my life. He's going to outlive me. Oh, God. You know, anyone else, at least you've got a chance that maybe eventually they'll pass on and you'll be free again. So, you know what? Buffy. Who wouldn't want to be married to Sarah Michelle Gellar for the rest of their life, right? Okay. That's my answer. Number 54. This one's from Brasky. Brasky says, three questions about dice. Which one spins the best? The die 20 spins the best. Maybe the 30, but I've never tried the 30. The 20 spins the best because it's just so darn easy. Which one do you enjoy spinning the most? Well, I gotta go with the 12 for that one. The 8 is a little awkward, and I don't know why. No, you know what? You know what spins the best? The 10. The 10 spins the best because it's balanced like a top. The thing actually, now that I think about it, no, you get much longer spins out of a 10 because it's got all that nice weight right around the middle that gives it a great, great long spin. So that's clearly the best. But the 12 is my favorite for spinning, just because I love 12s. I love everything about them. So die 12 for spinning, if it's my personal choice. And can you spin a traditional four-sided? I am going to say no. Can you as in can, is it possible? I'm sure someone can. Can I personally? I'm pretty sure I have tried it many, many times, and I have never gotten a sustained spin out of a four. I'm sure I've managed to get the thing to go around two or three times before it topples over, maybe even a little bit better than that. But I have never gotten a solid, sustained spin out of a dive four ever in my life. I'm sure of it. Number 40. Sirius Paul chimes in again, and Paul says, what happens when you stick a portable hole in a bag of holding? Okay, I know that there's rules for this, and I think when you get a portable hole and a bag of holding, you put one inside the other. I think if you go one way, it rips a hole into the ethereal plane. And if you go the other way, it just destroys them and they both disappear, or they're rendered inert or something like that, along with all of their contents. Either way you do it, you're going to lose everything you've got inside that bag, unless you follow them into the ethereal and start gathering up your spilled stuff. I think that's what the rules say. Now, if it were in my campaign, I would say that if you put a portable hole... Well, all right, first off, let's go the easy way. If you put a bag of holding inside of a portable hole, I would say nothing happens. You can just take your bag of holding inside your portable hole and nobody gives a crap. It's no big deal. If you were to take your portable hole inside your bag of holding, though, especially if you were to open up the portable hole inside the bag of holding, then yes, you would wind up tearing a hole in space-time that could take you anywhere, depending on what my plot needed at that exact moment. I would be thrilled to death if I had my players throw a portable hole inside a bag of holding in one of my games, because it gives me free license to go nuts on that. I can do anything with it. And I'm not just taking you to the ethereal plane, because that sucker's boring, all right? I'm dumping you out into one of the pits of the abyss, all right? I'm tearing you a hole through, not even the land of shadow, because you know what? I've done the land of shadow. I'm done with that one. I'm taking you to an alternate Earth. I am dropping you through time. I'm going to do something horrifying. Seriously, how cool would that be that you throw your portable hole into your bag of holding, and now suddenly a huge chasm opens up, and your players are dropped 1,000 years into the past, into the Age of Legends. And suddenly, they're forced to meet up with all these mythic beings that they've only heard whispers about for their whole lives. And it turns out some of them are just as mythic as the legends say, and some of them kind of aren't. And how much fun would you have? I could do a whole campaign that way. Oh, I so want to do a whole campaign that way. I would love to do a campaign. Well, you know what, though? Okay, here's the problem. It requires having a set of legends established first, and then... So you'd have to have a whole campaign that gives hints and stories and stuff like that, so you can establish your legends first. And then your next campaign, new characters, drop them through the hole right into the Age of Legends. And now they get to start from there. And the entire campaign is run there. And they whatever they're doing, they think they're doing to save the future. And maybe they are. To save their world or who knows what. And okay, my mind's going a mile a minute. I love this stuff. Okay, anyway, R2, your turn. Number 7, 8, Sirius Paul again. Sirius Paul says, this is not even a complete sentence, Paul. It says, favorite RPG supplement, ? My favorite RPG supplement? I don't even have to think about this one. Acute Paranoia. Paranoia 2nd Edition was my favorite edition of Paranoia ever. I liked it better than the 1st edition. Certainly liked it better than 5th edition. There was no 3rd and 4th. Liked it better than Paranoia XP. I have not tried the newest version that's out yet. I can't compare it. But Paranoia 2nd edition was the greatest Paranoia game ever. It is the gold standard for that game. And after I got the original rulebook for 2nd edition, I found the supplement Acute Paranoia. And it was... It shaped how we played that game. I love that supplement because it gave us a little bit of everything. Some new secret societies, some new rules for robots, some new equipment. But the very best thing that it had, I can't even tell you. Okay, it had the Mark IV adventure in it, which if you've ever played Paranoia at all, or if you've listened to me talk about Paranoia at all, you would have some passing familiarity with the Mark IV, the concept of it, the concept of the adventure. And so it had that one. But then it also had a bunch of Code 7 adventures. I think that's what they called them, Code 7. That was literally like several pages of just great plot ideas. They didn't bother to spell it out. They didn't do a whole lot of detail. They gave you a page. And the page said, okay, here's how the mission briefing would go, and here's kind of what they're doing, and this is kind of why it's impossible and how the players are going to get stuck. Now go, run it. That's it. No detail. They didn't give you names. They didn't give you details. They didn't give you anything. They said, hey, here's a cool idea. See if you can make a game out of that. And they gave you a bunch of these. It was unreal. I loved that. I was inspired by that. When my brother and I wrote 50 Bar Encounters, which if you haven't been to our games page, go to our games page, look at 50 Bar Encounters. It's intended to be 50 random encounters that could happen in a bar in a D&D style world. That's all it is, all right? And it's not, and we wrote it for D&D 3rd edition, but it doesn't make any difference. You can use it anywhere. And you just take those, and each idea is, you know, half a page, a page, and all you do is take the ideas and then make something out of it. And some of these bar encounters, and I've used a bunch of them in my own games, some of them are just interesting side encounters. They've chosen to go to a bar or an inn, and so give them something interesting to do while they're there. Some of them have turned out to be major plot hooks or major plot points. I've got one of those bar encounters. I'm actually using it as a way station for them. This is going to be a recurring thing that comes back to them. Great ideas. And this is what Acute Paranoia did with its Code 7 adventures, is it gave you a whole string of great ideas, and it didn't muck them up with a bunch of details, a bunch of plans to follow. It just said, hey, here's a great idea. See if you can make it work. And we did. Some of the greatest games we played came out of those. The very greatest of them, Whitewash. All right. In Whitewash, in Paranoia, the players are told that there is a hallway that was accidentally painted white, and their job is to go paint it black again. Because if it's a black hallway, anyone is free to use it. If it's a white hallway, only people of ultraviolet clearance can get through. So only the elite of the elite, the high programmers, only they can make it through. And so now we've got all these poor little low-level workers that can't get to work, and jobs aren't getting done. Production has ground to a halt because, well, this one hallway accidentally got painted white. And so it's up to the players to go out and paint it black. But they're not given any black paint. They're not given anything. In fact, the mission's supposed to be a secret because you can't let the computer know that it's screwed up. And so now they show up here dressed for an Arctic mission because they had to fool the mission briefing machines. And so they are dressed all in these huge heavy coats, dressed for an Arctic mission with snowshoes and winter gear and all of this. No paint, no nothing. And now they're standing in this hallway. And that's it. That's the whole thing that the Code 7 mission gives you. And we took that, and my players went with it for the most rip-roaring game we've ever played. It was so much fun, and they tore it up. I mean, destruction everywhere. It was awesome. So I love Paranoia. I love Acute Paranoia. Greatest game supplement ever. Good question, Paul. Number 14. This one's from Rave Master. Hey, I already said hi, Rave, but hi again. Do you like M&Ms with or without peanuts? With peanuts. When I was a kid, because I have bad teeth, which have been corrected with surgery since then, but when I was a kid, I had bad teeth, didn't chew very well, didn't care for peanuts, didn't care for steaks. I really liked processed foods because they were softer and easier on my poor teeth. Now that I'm an adult and I don't have that same concern and I've got really good dental work and it's all good for me, I love M&Ms with peanuts. Awesome stuff. Number 59. This one's from Serious Paul. We haven't heard from you in a while. How do you like your eggs cooked? I like eggs pretty much any way I get them. I enjoy fried eggs on toast the best. I love fried eggs with some kind of toast or bagel or some kind of bread that I can dip into it or put the eggs on or whatever. And fried so that they're soft in the middle. Over easy to over medium would be my preference. That would be my favorite way to have eggs. But right now I have a fridge full of hard-boiled Easter eggs, and I love hard-boiled eggs. I love hard-boiled eggs. I love deviled eggs. You mash those suckers up and make me some egg salad. Hard-boiled eggs are awesome. Give me some poached eggs and an eggs benedict. Oh, my! That was when I was in college. The restaurant I worked at made an awesome eggs benedict. And I must have eaten that three times a week for the longest time. I love Eggs Benedict. Scrambled? Oh, I'll take some good scrambled eggs. Give me some good scrambled eggs with some heavy pepper. That is great stuff. Or, better yet, do me an egg scramble with sausage and hash browns and cheese mixed into it. Oh, that is the most decadent meal ever. That thing is so heavy, but so good. Yeah, I just like eggs. But fried eggs to start with. But, you know, honestly, any eggs are good with me. I'm cool. Number 93. This one is from Billy Bob. All right, Billy Bob's got a long one, as usual. In a true ultimate showdown of ultimate destiny, who would have won? All right, before I finish this question, the ultimate showdown of ultimate destiny, if you guys haven't seen it, go look it up on YouTube. It's out there. It's by, I think it's by Lemon Demon, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, it's a song and a video of if you get all the greatest heroes and villains of the world together and they all fight, who comes out on top? And so there's Batman and Abe Lincoln and Chuck Norris and... Anyway, there's a lot of them. Bill and Ted show up. So anyway, Billy Bob continues. Tell the truth. Mr. Rogers would have gone down like a bitch in the first round, and Chuck Norris's roundhouse kick of doom would have won the whole thing. Am I right or am I right? No, you're not right. All right, first off, you don't talk that way about Mr. Rogers, all right? Yes. Mr. Rogers is a lover, not a fighter. He would have gone down in the first round. That is absolutely true. I have no qualms with that, but you do not talk that way about Mr. Rogers. Do you understand me, young man? All right. Second of all, Chuck Norris's roundhouse kick of doom? Are you kidding with me? Chuck Norris is not the ultimate fighter. I know we've got the Chuck Norris jokes. I know we do, but guess what? I'm tired of them. All right? Supply those jokes to somebody else because I'm tired of Chuck Norris jokes. Chuck Norris would not have won. Clearly, and I've mentioned this many times in the past, Batman would have won. All right? Why? Because Batman has plans for how to kill all of them. Yeah, you know what? You're throwing in people from the Marvel Universe? Don't care. Batman had plans for that. All right? The Terminator? Yeah, you know what? Batman had plans for that. Batman is ready for all of them. Indiana Jones, why was he even competing? The dude's an archaeologist with a whip, all right? A very lucky archaeologist with a whip who can survive nuclear blasts, apparently, but he's an archaeologist, for God's sake, all right? Batman wins, because Batman wins. You don't need any other reason than that. Number 90, is it just me, or are we getting a lot of the 90s this week? Number 90 is from Brasky. Brasky asks me, how many digits of pi do you have memorized? Let me see. 3.14159265, I think. And then that's all I've got. I did. What is that, 11? I stopped somewhere around 9 or 10. I think that was 11. All right, I don't know. But that's what... back when I was a mathlete, and I don't think we went by the name of mathlete back then, but I went to a math competition, and that was the tiebreaker question on our test. We were working in groups, we were solving math problems, and the tiebreaker was, list as many digits of pi as you possibly can. And I wound up getting it right out to, at that time I had 3.14159, and I knew, now I know it, 926. But I'm positive on that one. I put down 962. And nobody else in the group even came close. So they went with my answer. And so we wound up with only 6 correct digits. And we lost the tiebreaker because of it. So since then, I've memorized a few more. But I can't do... I mean, there are people who can literally do thousands of digits of pi from memory. Oh, my God. That is amazing to me. I can't get that far. Like I say, 10, 11, if I worked really hard at it, I could maybe get up to 20, but it would require work, and I don't... That doesn't seem to have a payoff for me when my Excel spreadsheet has a pi function. I mean, I don't get it. Number 92 from Talvin. Hey, Talvin. Talvin has got another Kiss, Marry, Kill for me. His is Zooey Deschanel, Katy Perry, and Rosie O'Donnell. First off, did you know Zooey Deschanel is her sister is the gal from Bones? I did not know that until like a week ago. I was so surprised. All right, anyway. Zooey Deschanel, Katy Perry, and Rosie O'Donnell. And I see why you picked these three, because obviously the three of them all look so much alike that I can't really tell the difference. So shuffle them up, put in any order. I can't choose. No, I can't leave the joke there. God, I was going to have R2 roll the dice. No, kill Rosie O'Donnell. Then I don't care what happens. Okay, let's go. No, all right. No, darn it. All right. God, darn it. All right. Kill Rosie O'Donnell. Wild Night of Passion with Katy Perry. I'll marry Zooey Deschanel because she's, you know, the perfect pixie dream girl. And, you know, you have to do that because you're a nerd and there's no other choice to make. Okay, done. There. 43. Haven't we done 43? No? No, we haven't. Okay. Serious Paul says, what is the best order of the stick moment you can remember? Huh. All right. In order, maybe? I've got like six of them. Let me hold on. All right, I don't know how many I got. I was trying to catalog them in my head. I'll just give them to you really quick. When Belcar, and if you have not read Order of the Stick, go over to giantitp.com, Giant in the Playground, giantitp.com, or just go to Google and search for Order of the Stick. Go read every episode of Order of the Stick from beginning to end, and then you can come back and listen to the podcast because I don't want to give away any spoilers. All right, now, the first greatest moment is when Belcar first wakes up and declares himself to be a sexy, shoeless god of war. I peed myself more than a little bit when that happened, because that was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Sexy, shoeless god of war, hands down, greatest moment in that comic ever. Okay. After that, there's some toss-ups. I can tell you chronologically, but okay. Episode 400? Issue 400? I don't know what you call them. Anyway, comic 400. When Haley and Elon, it was beautiful and it was long awaited and I was very moved. And it was at number 400 that it finally occurred to me that stick figure comic or no, I was completely and totally emotionally invested in this comic and totally bought it and was rooting for them as much as I would any movie or book or, I mean, again, emotional investment. That's powerful. And then, oh, there's one in the middle that I'm forgetting that I really, really like, but maybe I'll remember it next week. But then recently, there have been two of them in recent issues, like in the last 20 issues. There have been a couple of brilliant moments. Okay, but in recent episodes, when Red Cloak finally reveals his master plan, and this is just recently, and he reveals his master plan, and then he had, God, if you haven't read it, I don't want to give anything away, but it was overwhelming. It was so good. You should go read it. Damn it. If you haven't read it, maybe you won't even remember by the time you get to this part. But he takes his opposition and feeds her to the ghouls, and then has the ghouls destroy themselves, and then he walks out with frickin' ice in his veins because he's Red Cloak. He's Red Cloak. Oh, it was awesome. And then, not like a half dozen comics later, we get this big revelation of whatever happened to the Drake Tooth family. And when we find out what happened to the Drake Tooth family, I mean, my gut fell out. I was like, oh, I totally didn't see that coming, even though all the clues were there. Punch me in the face. It was tough. So, Order of the Stick. Powerful. God, there's still one I'm missing. Doesn't matter. Go read Order of the Stick. I don't know how many times I have to tell you people this. Seriously. Number 96. See, I told you, it's the 90s. It's, all right. Serious Paul says, what is your favorite Huey Lewis and the News track? What is the title of that thing? Bad. Bad is Bad. That is my favorite Huey Lewis and the News track. I mean, I loved everything Huey Lewis and the News, but this was off their sports album, I guess. And and Huey Lewis. I saw Huey Lewis and the News in concert, baby. All right. I went and saw them live in concert in the 80s, and it was incredible. And I don't care how cheesy they are. They were my favorite band for the longest time. And Bad is Bad is just a great song. You got this bit when we saw them in concert, when it gets to the when he gets to the line of, he goes, "There's a strange pair of shoes," and he stops, and the whole audience goes crazy. Underneath the bed, we're singing along with him. We didn't realize it was cheese. We didn't know. We thought it was good music, and it was so cool. So that's my favorite. I like lots of Huey Lewis in the News. All right, don't get me started. You already did. Too late. But that's the best one. 97. Go, all right. 97 from Brasky. With the Muppet movie recently released, please provide your fondest memories of the old Muppet show. Did you like Bunsen and Beaker? Waldorf and the other guy? Swedish Chef? Pigs in Space? All right. That's a great question. And I'll tell you what, Brasky. Bunsen and Beaker are always my favorite. By far. And you know what? I don't even like Bunsen that much. I mean, except that he's, you know, he's got to be the foil to Beaker's straight man. I love Beaker. Right? Beaker's the best Muppet ever, hands down. But I liked all of it. All right. Waldorf and Statler, by the way, that's his name. You knew that. And I know you knew that, but that's all right. Statler and Waldorf were all right. Swedish Chef still was incredibly funny when we were kids. And it's the same thing every single time. I mean, it's him coming out in a ludicrous situation with the real human hands poking up, and then he throws things around, makes a huge mess, and babbles on in this incredibly stupid fake Swedish accent that apparently sounds Norwegian. And it was the exact same joke every time. And yet, as kids, we laughed and laughed. Okay, it's not quite up there in my favorites now, but I remember loving the Swedish Chef as a kid. Pigs in Space and Veterinarian's Hospital and those, I liked those a lot. And they were nothing really but one-liners. I mean, you know, it was their drama series that they introduced to basically have, you know, Piggy and Janice and whoever played Captain Link and Rolf and all of them, to have them come out and just throw out their one-liners at each other through the whole thing. You know, you give me a setup, I give you a one-liner. Done. And I loved those. But Beaker's the best. Absolutely. Number 73 from Brasky again, two in a row. Who was your favorite defender? And if you don't say Moondragon, I'll kill you. Oh, you didn't even like Moondragon. Stop that. My favorite defender, at the time, probably Gargoyle. I liked Gargoyle a lot, but in retrospect, actually, and this may surprise you, because I think this is going to be your favorite as well, Valkyrie. I loved Valkyrie in The Defenders. I thought she was great. Because she was literally a Valkyrie. That was it. And she was awesome. But, you know, also, I've always had a fondness for Beast. And Beast ranks right up there. But I think Valkyrie was probably the most interesting of the characters. That's my take. Last one. Okay, number 56. This one comes from Billy Bob again. Billy Bob says, "Hey, you said you'd tell us stories about driving a cab if we asked. So you drove a cab?" Yes, I did, sir. When my last son was born, to get some extra money, I started driving a cab here in town. Crappy job. But the bonus to it was for 6 months out of the year, whatever it was, well, 9 months, actually, they ran the whole school year, the cab would get contracted out to a local college, which was 30 miles away. And so Thursday nights was the party night at this college, and we would go out. There'd be usually two cabs, sometimes three, depends on how heavy the season was going. And we would go out there at 10 o'clock at night, and we were paid by the college, and the college kids ran dispatch for us. And then we would spend from 10 o'clock at night till 2 o'clock in the morning just taking kids home. Any college kid, if they had a college ID on them, then we would pick them up. We would take them wherever they wanted to go. We would take them to the bars. We would take them back home from the bars, find them at parties. Sometimes it was a study group that met at McDonald's, and we just picked them up and took them home after they got done studying. And that's what we did. And that, still the most fun I've ever had at a job ever. I mean, it's a crappy job. The hours were obviously terrible, and it wiped out my weekends. And by the time I was done with it, I was glad to be out of there. But I still miss it because there's some. Okay, first off, nobody's paying for the cab. The college pays for it. So all these kids that are riding, it's all free. All right. And they're all, 90% of them are partying. So they're all in a great mood. Everybody's happy. They're throwing tips at you. And on top of that, you get that happy social aspect where everyone's positive. Everyone's in a great mood. And then you get the math, geometry portion of it where I take calls and I'm running them all in my head and I'm figuring out, okay, if I've got these three to pick up, what order do I stop in? Who's going to take how long? Just the logistics of getting everybody where they're going and still having room. I love doing that. Love that. It was, your mind is going a mile a minute all night long. And it was a great time. Love doing that job. But you want to hear a story about driving cab. I'm trying to figure out which story would be most appropriate. Because, you know, here's the deal. Driving cab, I would guess that there were maybe a half dozen times in the year or so that I did this, maybe a half dozen times that I would look in my rearview mirror and there would be two hot college girls making out in the back seat, okay, which is interesting, but in general, well, not even in general, every time they did it, every time I had two girls making out in the back of the cab, every time it was two girls sitting in between their two boyfriends, okay? So it's not even like you've got real lesbians in the cab. It's just these are two hot girls who are making out for the benefit of their boyfriends. They're just showing off, and that's all they're doing. And that happened quite a lot, really. I once had, there was four people in the cab, three guys and a girl, and they had a wager. We were going out to the gas station on the edge of town, and they had a wager. Basically, she kept saying, there's no way they're going to have that at the gas station. There's no way you're going to be able to buy that at the gas station. And it was, you know, some frozen food. I mean, it was something stupid. And they got out there, and apparently she was wrong. All right. And so she was completely embarrassed and ashamed that she was wrong. And now she's clearly nervous. And so they get back to the house. All right. They'd gotten whatever they're going to get at the gas station. I drive them back to the house where they're getting out at. And apparently for losing the bet, she hops out of the cab, strips off all of her clothes standing there on the curb, and then runs twice around the house. That was apparently her forfeit for losing the bet. That was the most bizarre thing ever. I've got some others, but you know what? I'm going to save those until somebody asks again. In the meantime,
remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
Thank you, GLaDOS. This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. This week's theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write us a nice review. We always love that. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest with you, you know the very best way to talk to me is come over, sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up, you send me a message, we'll hang out, we will have fun. Okay, after a little discussion with Zimney Pot, it was suggested that maybe for this closing bit, I could be doing some more fan fiction here. I mean, the wrestling fan fiction went over really well, didn't it? Okay. So with that in mind, I went out and did some searching for some really awesome fan fiction that I could be putting up here. And my goal is I want fan fiction that maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, that doesn't matter. I just want fan fiction that shows people investing a little time, something that's entertaining for 5 minutes of the podcast, but shows people who love what they're doing, all right, and they put themselves into it. And I was going to do a Simpsons fan fiction because it was just funny to me, but while I was sending it over to Yancey for proofreading, I then came across the greatest fan fiction of all time, a Dragon Ball Z Anne Frank's Diary crossover fan fiction. Are you kidding me? This is the best ever. So, let's get right into it. This is Goku and Anne Frank in a story entitled Until the End of Time by someone named Gopher-chan. Anne sighed as she sat in her room staring at her wall. She just finished writing in her diary and had nothing to do. Life was boring in the secret annex, but it was better than the alternative. It was all right talking to Peter and Margot, but they were both such boring people, unlike the always active Anne. All of a sudden, a flash of light appeared in the room. Anne jumped back, stifling a scream. Before she could run out the closed door, she noticed that the person who appeared in the flash was not a Nazi officer, but someone who she had never seen before. His clothes were very strange, and his hair was in a spiky style that was totally new to her. She stood against the wall, wary of the stranger. But he walked towards her and smiled, extending a hand. "My name is Goku," the mysterious stranger said. Anne nervously put her hand in his. He bent down and kissed it softly, then let go. Anne blushed, feeling something she had never felt before go off inside her. "My name is Anne," she replied quietly. "I'm sorry for what just happened," Goku told her, "but I was caught in a time portal and deposited here. My power cells will recharge soon, but until then, I'm stuck here." Anne had no idea what the handsome visitor was talking about, but she played along. "Well, sir," she said, "you may stay in my room as long as you like." Anne blushed again as she said this and giggled slightly. Goku looked around and then sat on the bed. "Thank you for the invitation. I'll be sure to repay you for it soon." Anne did not understand what he meant by that. However, when he spoke, she felt a warmth deep inside of her. She sat by him on the bed, staring at the man's beautiful eyes. Finally, she could stand it no longer. Anne leaned over and kissed the stranger on his cheek, and then pulled back quickly, not sure of what she had done. "I'm sorry," she said, as she fumbled to find the right words. The visitor smirked. "No, that's quite all right," he replied with a smile, putting one arm around her. "You know, you're a very beautiful girl, but well. Anne looked at him, troubled. "What's the matter?" she said with a sweet smile. Goku looked nervous. I'm already married. He finally managed to choke it out. Anne pulled away from him abruptly. "No," she said loudly, almost in tears. "I'm sorry," he replied. Anne was furious. "Nothing ever goes right," she cried out. "I have to go now. My power cells are recharged," said Goku. Anne was in tears by now, staring at the wall so she wouldn't see Goku's face. He smiled a sad smile and disappeared in another flash out of Anne's life forever. Anne never forgot him, though. Not until the end of time. 1 month. Well, it didn't feel like a month. To Anne Frank, a Jew in hiding from the Nazis, it seemed like a year. 1 month since the fateful encounter with a mysterious man from another world who she only knew as Goku. The handsome stranger had stepped through time and into her life, then disappeared without a trace. Anne was almost sure they'd never meet again, even though not one day passed without her dreaming of him. Little did she know, however, that their lives were tied by the unbreakable red string of fate. It was another boring day in the secret annex. Anne sat on the bed of her room, writing in her diary. It never occurred to her, however, that this entry would be her last. As she wrote in the quiet attic, there was a loud noise from downstairs. Her heart jumped with both fear and excitement. Was it them? The Nazis? Or could it be him? She had no idea whether to run downstairs or to hide. The decision, however, was made for her. Her door flew open, and a tall soldier was visible in the doorway, glaring at her. The cries of her family members and friends were tuned out as Anne thought of only one thing. She stood up and followed the soldier out of the room, down the stairs, and into the back of the truck. "So this is it," she said quietly to herself. "I'll never see him, my one true love, ever again. And all those years of hiding, they were for naught." Then Anne realized that she left her precious diary up in her room. She broke loose from the officer and made a dash back into the shop. When he removed a gun from his holster and fired a shot in her direction, Anne fell to the floor. Anne lay on the floor, feeling searing pain running through her leg where the bullet had met its mark. The Gestapo officer menacingly moved towards her, grinning, when all of a sudden there was a blinding flash of light, causing the officer to shield his eyes. A huge cloud of smoke appeared next to Anne, blocking her from the soldier's vision. When the smoke cleared, he was in for quite a surprise. There was Goku, holding Anne in his arms, standing next to a huge metal capsule. "Goku," cried Anne, "you came back, for me!" Goku smiled. "Anything for you, my dear," he said. "Our love will never be lost, not until the end of time." The Gestapo officer turned tail and ran, but Goku was too quick for him. After laying Ann on the concrete, he dashed towards the Nazi and knocked him to the ground unconscious with only one blow. "Nazi scum," muttered Goku as he spit on his enemy's limp body, then returned to Ann. "Here, I have something for you," Goku said as he removed a small bean from his pocket. "What on earth is this?" asked Ann. Goku smiled, remembering how ignorant she was to what was everyday life for him. "A senzu bean," he said. "Just eat it, and it will cure your leg." Ann followed his instructions and popped the bean into her mouth, as the wound on her calf magically healed. "Now, come on," he commanded. "We've got some Nazi ass to kick." Ann jumped on the mysterious Saiyan's back as he launched off into the sky. After only a few moments, the two of them arrived in Berlin. Tanks were parading down the street as Adolf Hitler himself stood on a platform overlooking it all. "Stay here," Goku said, dropping Ann in a shaded area under a tree. He then flew straight towards the parade of tanks, fists outstretched, screaming as loud as he could. The soldiers below scattered in terror while tanks tried to aim their cannons at him. He was too quick and nimble for them, however, and opened the hatch of a nearby panzer, then headed inside. After dispatching the soldiers in control of the war machine, he took the wheel. He fired round after round into the crowds of Nazi soldiers, occasionally firing at the other tanks. After only minutes, there was nothing but a cloud of dust and corpses. Goku emerged from the tank's hatch, smiling now that he had done his duty. When all of the dust cleared, there were only two people remaining on the parade ground. Goku, the Saiyan hero, and Adolf Hitler, the most evil man to ever walk the earth. Anne watched from nearby, fearfully, as she saw the two men stare at each other for what seemed like hours. Her one true love, and her ultimate oppressor. It had come down to this. "So," Hitler said jovially, "you took out all of my men. However, you aren't going to defeat me." Hitler then jumped down from his platform and down onto the street in front of Goku, pulling a chain gun from the ground nearby. Goku quickly jumped behind a ruined tank as Adolf opened fire. The tank made decent cover, but it wasn't long until it would be torn apart by the hail of bullets. Goku had to act. He dashed out from the side of the tank and flew as fast as he could towards Hitler, who had no time to react. He grabbed the chain gun out of his enemy's hands and snapped it over his knee with ease. Hitler stumbled backward, shocked at this turn of events. Goku smirked, then said, "It's come down to this. You and me, fighting like men. If you admit defeat now, I'll kill you rather painlessly." Goku had the definite advantage, or so it seemed. Hitler burst into a laugh as Goku looked on quizzically. The mustachioed man slowly rose into the air as his brown hair and pencil mustache turned a blonde color and his brown eyes turned blue. Goku reeled in horror. Hitler continued laughing, then finally said, "Goku, you came here expecting to fight a madman, but instead you found a god." Hitler had become a Super Saiyan. Anne looked on in awe, not sure what was going on. At first it seemed like her lover would win the battle, but now she was not so sure. Goku now seemed scared of his opponent, and it was for good reason. Hitler continued to speak. "Goku, can't you see? I've reached a power level 10 times anything you've ever achieved. Your fate is sealed, weakling." Even though the battle seemed unwinnable, Goku charged in, screaming at the top of his lungs. Every blow he struck was deflected off Hitler's rock-hard body. Hitler waited for Goku to tire himself out, and then raised his fist and punched Goku, and one punch was enough. Goku was knocked across the street into a large propaganda poster of Hitler, thudding to the cold, hard ground. Hitler laughed, thinking that victory was in his hands at last. Goku, however, was not ready to give up. Bruised and battered, he rose from the ground, limping in Hitler's direction. The Nazi leader laughed. "You still want to fight? Don't you know when to give up, boy? You can hardly walk, and you expect to beat me, conqueror of Europe?" Goku ignored Adolf's taunts as he continued to stumble his way forward. Finally, the two arch-rivals were standing face to face. Goku stared Hitler into the eye and then screamed, "This is for love!" and flew up into the sky, his hair turning blonde, his eyes blue, and the aura of power radiating from him. Hitler looked on in horror at Goku. He had made the ultimate achievement. He had become a super ultra power Saiyan. Goku made a cup shape with his hands, aiming at Hitler as he belted out the words, "Kamehameha!" as a beam of pure energy shot at his enemy, disintegrating the Nazi leader's body. Goku then collapsed to the ground in a heap, exhausted from the fight. 2 years later, Ann and Goku had finally reached the date of their wedding. After the battle, Ann and Goku had destroyed the time machine and took a boat to Australia. They changed their names and lived a new life, ready to start over. The two young people looked into each other's eyes as they kissed, as the Reverend pronounced them man and wife. Finally, it seemed, Anne was at peace, and they would always be together until the end of time. Isn't that beautiful? That's just great. Hitler had become a Super Saiyan. Maybe I should just clip all this commentary off the end. Maybe the whole thing stands by itself. As lovingly as this was crafted, is there not an ominous undertone to the fact that when they become super powerful, these normally darker men become blonde-haired and blue-eyed in order to reach ultimate power? Does that not ring a little creepy in this context? What an amazing piece of work. I have nothing else I can say about that. Really.